Welcome to this special Think Tank edition of Breast Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. We gathered 12 clinical investigators for a day-long roundtable discussion, which was structured around a series of poll questions and a survey completed by the faculty in the 2 days prior to the meeting. The full results of this survey are presented in the monograph accompanying this program. The first questions related to the duration of adjuvant aromatase inhibitor therapy and delayed use of AIs. We first presented a 60-year-old woman who completed 5 years of tamoxifen for a tumor with 4 positive nodes in which the tamoxifen had been completed 3 years previously. 8 of the 12 faculty members would start an AI at that point. We then presented the same patient with 4 positive nodes, but this time having received 5 years of an AI, and 4 faculty would continue therapy, and 2 others would offer continuation. In the monograph, you'll also see that we presented these same scenarios, but in patients age 81. Dr. Kathy Pritchard began the related discussion by commenting on the initiation of an AI some years after having completed prior tamoxifen therapy.
There's good data now from the MA17 study that in the women who were on placebo when the trial stopped, they crossed over, that they've done actually even better than the originally randomized women for reasons I don't understand, and that's not a randomized comparison. But I think it gives us a pretty clear signal that even starting 1, 2, or 3 years out from finishing tamoxifen, that the AIs still have an effect. So I think using an AI in this situation, even with the gap, is very logical. I think I was one of the people who probably said recommend an AI in both situations. And I guess the question with an 81-year-old is, how long does the average 81-year-old live? And she's still very high risk. And looking at the side effects from Haimas's paper is the suggestion that these older women aren't having very much problem with, at least in the short term, with quality of life. So I would think that both patients would be a candidate for an AI.
Paul, you know, people have really gotten used to using Peter Ravden's adjuvant online model sort of up front. He does have this sort of post 5 years of tamoxifen model, but there are just so many variables. Are we moving towards a situation where we're really going to be able to put a bunch of numbers in? They're 4 years from diagnosis, 8 years, and really come up with an absolute benefit?
We probably will eventually. Maybe not yet. There's still more data coming and follow-up. But I will make the general comment. I remember many years ago that we were interested in the outcome of elderly patients with lymphoma, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and people put quite a lot of effort into showing that anthracyclines were being underutilized in elderly patients with lymphoma, and actually the outcome would be far improved in those patients if they weren't disenfranchised from appropriate chemotherapy based on their age. And I do feel very strongly, not just because I've been so intimately involved with the results, but I do feel very strongly that we have a very large prevalent pool of receptor-positive breast cancer patients in the world, and that many of them have been incompletely treated, and we're seeing a benefit across a huge spectrum of time for the application of endocrine therapy. And I think that my own view, I strongly believe from going around the world talking, that endocrine therapy is being underutilized largely in the world, and that people should think, why shouldn't I give it rather than why should I give it? And I think I see patients being excluded based on age unnecessarily. I see them being excluded on things like they've got pre-existing osteoarthritis and other small trivial reasons that clinicians are dismissing the application of a treatment that's highly effective. And I think that this is a problem that needs to be addressed by the oncology community worldwide.
Is there an upper limit in terms of number of years since diagnosis or since tamoxifen where you just will say, hey, I think it's been too long?
The data is confined to a range of, I think it's 1 to 7 years after stopping tamoxifen from our post-unblinding analysis. But I think biologically, it was previously shown that if you initiate tamoxifen at any time in the pathway of this follow-up, you can affect some benefit. And I think that's true here. And I think what Kathy said was the impact on quality of life self-reported by these patients is zero in the elderly group. And there is a life expectancy. And the year-on-year prevention of an event is very substantial. So even if you take 12 months of this pill, many people think of this dichotomously. Should I give this old woman 5 years or not? And I think there's a middle road. Should I give her some? You can give 1 year or 2 years. We did this with tamoxifen for many years.
Matt, it's been kind of interesting. We have these meet the professor cases of women who were diagnosed when they were premenopausal, like in 1988, 1990, 1992, when we really weren't using endocrine therapy. Now it's 10, 15 years later. Now they're postmenopausal and they've never gotten hormonal therapy. How do you approach those kinds of patients, and should we be out there in surgeons' offices looking for people like that?
Well, obviously it represents a real conundrum. Clearly there is a point, I'm sure Paul will agree, where giving endocrine therapy is probably inappropriate. When that point is something that probably needs to be modeled. One would imagine that it could be as far out as 15 to 20 years. Certainly when you look at the MD Anderson data with the idea that the ER-positive patients have a poorer prognosis beyond 5 years, you know, it just underscores the fact that intervention could help. So we need some modeling, I think, here, and your idea of modifying Peter Rabdon's model to look at benefit at 8, 10, 12, 14, 15 years would be reasonable. One of the statistics I always like is the number needed to treat, because it's a very easy thing to think about. And I was actually going to ask Paul that, what the number needed to treat is, first of all, let's say in a relatively low-risk population. It's about 70. So what you would probably find once you get to, say, 10 years out and they haven't relapsed, the number needed to treat is probably twice that. And there's a threshold that you could choose, I think, from both a risk-benefit ratio and an economic sense, if your practice was driven by such considerations, to say the number needed to treat has exceeded a certain threshold and you're buying too much toxicity.
Eric?
Well, so Neil, you've encouraged us all not to agree with one another, so I'll step into the ring. I don't object to giving this woman an aromatase inhibitor now 8 years out. And I would agree that her median survival is probably in the range of 6 or 7 years. But I think it's extremely unlikely that any modeling approach or any clinical trial would ever demonstrate a survival advantage here. I think the disease-free survival advantage is likely going to be relatively modest. And in an 81-year-old, depending on her health, with other competing morbidities, the potential for taking other medications, I'm not going to push this woman very hard to take an aromatase inhibitor at this point in time. And I actually want to just ask Paul a question. Did you have a chance to look at adherence at all in older versus younger women? Because one possibility in terms of what looks like a slightly decreased effect, even though the p-value for the interaction term wasn't significant, is that either because of age in and of itself or because of age and comorbidities and the need to take other medications, that in fact some of the less apparent benefit may be because people aren't taking their drugs?
I can't answer with absolute certainty. I believe that the compliance was similar across the three groups. It's interesting. This point is to me very fascinating. There were about 10% of patients who dropped out of study for no apparent reason in MA17, wouldn't offer a reason. And it was balanced between placebo and drug. And there was about another 5% that dropped out for perceived toxicity balanced between placebo and drug. So there was no apparent difference in either. But I think the whole idea of oral medication and compliance is a really fascinating one. The question is, if people are less compliant than you hope, but you still get a powerful result, it means that in real clinical practice, you can go out and try to get that result and you'll probably get it. And it also means that if people were perfectly compliant, you'd get a better result,
sure,
but it would come at a higher cost. And I think that some of the drug companies are trying to develop programs to enforce compliance for patients on aromatase and other kinds of cancer therapies. And I'm actually somewhat against that because I think patients don't comply for internal reasons that are valid. And I think it'll come at increased toxicity. The cost will be marked increased toxicity if you enforce compliance.
Rowan?
I'm sure most of you are familiar with the data where in randomized trials it's about 15 to 20% dropout, but in clinical practice it's about 30 to 50%. And Partridge had a similar result this year at San Antonio with AIs. And so it looks like if you want to get the results seen in the clinical trials, we have to do something about adherence because it's going to be 20 or 30% of women above what it is in clinical trials are not taking their medications. It appears that one of the things that I was looking for was correlates, and it appeared that anxiety, depression, interestingly, changes from about 50% in the first year down to about 15% in the fifth year. And it looks very similar to the dropouts in terms of the inverse of the drop of not taking medications. And so I think we may be influencing something in practice in that we encourage the patients, they're doing well, the fourth year visit, the 10-minute visit that we're using as our own pick-me-up in the day doesn't give a message to the woman that she's at increased risk. It would be very interesting to do a survey to view women's perceived risk of recurrence at their fifth year, because I think a lot of them feel that they're done with their therapy. And it was interesting, when I was trying to present the MA17 data to patients when it first came out, and they would come back for the routine visit, I found that if people were over a year out from their therapy, hadn't been told that they were at risk, they didn't accept the fact that they were, I tried to convince them that now they're at risk and there's a therapy that could work, and they interestingly weren't accepting it. So I think maybe we have a lot to do with it, the way we set up the women. And the question is, do we have to kind of place them more at anxiety or let them more realistically learn about the recurrence risk, back to this point that Paul was making about should we enforce adherence? Is it better to have someone scared about their breast cancer recurrence but taking the medication?
I think we show them some of those curves in terms of delayed recurrence and maybe raise a little anxiety. Brian?
One thing I would just like to ask you, Rowan, did you look at compliance by age? Because other ClinPharm studies have suggested that compliance gets worse as you get older.
Yeah, there were very few studies that looked at adherence. And actually, the one study that looked at it was worse in the younger individuals taking oral hormonal therapies. And maybe the thought that I had, which I haven't seen a correlation, is those women would have been taking more chemotherapy, as we saw here. And I think in a number of clinical practices, there's a big to-do when you're done with chemotherapy. You're finishing 6 months of chemotherapy, and maybe they feel more that they're done with their therapy than a woman who's just getting hormone therapy.
Aman?
Yeah, the point I wanted to make is that the patients which you talked about, the first patient, she had multiple positive nodes. If we look at the risk of recurrence, patients with positive nodes have a higher risk of recurrence compared to the negative nodes. But when you follow these patients and look at their hazard plots, after 3 to 5 years, the risk of recurrence between node positive, node negative, 1, 2, 3, 4 or more, becomes much more closer. So I think that is one factor which we have to keep in mind. And the second thing is that, yes, our gut reaction is that we should be subscribing aromatase inhibitor and endocrine therapy to these patients. But right now we don't have any strong evidence in support of that, except for that MA17 data, which was post-code breaking, and then the patients were given the choice, not randomized, given the choice, and then looking at that data, which is not planned. And I think that we need to wait until we have the prospectively randomized studies before we jump the gun and say that we should be offering these type of therapies to all patients.
You're talking about when there's a delay.
When there is a delay.
So how much of a delay gets you uncomfortable?
I advise the patient if the window is within the MA17 period.
Which is?
Which is about 6 months either direction.
6 months. Okay, Paul?
Actually, I'll let people who are involved in the Oxford overview comment, but MA17 did not show what Aman's saying, that there's a diminishing difference between node positive and node negative patients across time. In fact, it was very constant, the difference. I think the Oxford overview shows the same thing.
Yeah, I agree. As far as we can tell, it looks like a steady rate, and it's about half for the node negatives that it is for the node positives, which is where one might draw some lines. But I don't think that we have terribly good long-term concept of where this data goes after 10 years and 15 years. We know people are still recurring, but we may not have the exact magnitude of that really pinned down so well as one would like.
Aman, do you agree with what they're saying about the overview?
I have looked at the overview, and I was in the same meeting where they were in the same rooms. So I think it is how you interpret the data.
I think, though, Aman, if I may say, that the overview still remains the overview. MA17 is a prospective double-blind randomized trial, and the event rate in the placebo arm is the most accurate data you could wish for in North America. It's 5,000 patients randomized from Canada and the United States in community practice, and the event rate's the event rate, and it remains consistently double in the node-positive patients compared to node-negative year on year in the MA17 trials. I think it's probably the best data that there is.
I do not disagree that patients with ER-positive disease continue to relapse for a long period of time. Question which we are talking about, outside the context of a clinical trial, offering therapy 3, 4, 5, or 7 years after the patient is alive, free of disease, offering an intervention of no established value at that point, is it appropriate and it is the current standard of practice? I seriously have serious reservation about that.
I think it's a good point. There's a trial that's being launched by the International Breast Cancer Study Group of Australia and New Zealand, the LATER trial, that are going to attempt to randomize such patients. So I do agree a randomized trial would be preferable, but it'll be many, many years. And I find it difficult to imagine that, albeit not level one evidence, with a very strong biological effect we're seeing in MA17, and with it being corroborated by a random introduction of tamoxifen in the course of the disease as well, adjuvant tamoxifen, I find it hard to imagine that one can say that there's no likelihood of impacting on events in patients with receptor-positive disease in follow-up.
And also, I want to clarify, for these poll questions in general, it's the same thing as with interviews. We're asking you, what do you do in your practice, not what you consider standard of care. I mean, what's your best judgment? Joe?
What I was going to say, just related to not only this situation, but how I approach situations that we all deal with commonly in practice, and that is to try and separate in my own mind and clarify that for the patient exactly what information we're presenting and recommendations we're making that are clearly data-driven, where we have clear, unequivocal proof that that is the appropriate choice, versus situations where we don't have clear data and where our recommendations are just that, recommendations based on our own intuition and working with the patient to try and devise a plan that best suits their situation. And here we're clearly in a situation for a patient who's completed 5 years of AI therapy, where the AI was given up front, where we're treading in water that's not data-driven. And in terms of how I approach that particular problem, really it comes down to what's the individual's risk of recurrence as it was estimated at baseline. Secondly, how well they tolerated the drug. Thirdly, the other factors, for example, the age, how many other medications is the patient taking, comorbidities, et cetera.
John, I think I've seen a shift, and we really try to keep our finger on the pulse of what people are doing and thinking, and just, I'd say, in the last 6 months or a year, towards being open to continuing an AI after 5 years. Prior to that time, like, everybody was saying, stop. What's your approach in a non-protocol setting?
Well, off of trial, I think the continuation of an aromatase inhibitor beyond 5 years is fairly speculative. And we've got a fairly good grasp of the toxicities of 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor. I think some of the best data probably comes from the ATAC trial. But if you look, some of the potential side effects of these therapies could be cumulative over time. And we would expect higher degrees of bone toxicity, probably with extended duration AI therapy. And I think one of the biggest worries would be neuropsychiatric complications of long-term estrogen deprivation. There's a lot of data from epidemiologic studies that lower serum estrogens are associated with a higher risk of dementia. Not that supplementary estrogen is of any benefit, but it's an open question. So in my practice, I don't continue patients beyond 5 years of an AI because of the lack of data and the potential for long-term outcomes that we don't have a good handle on.
I want to ask Rowan about this issue of cognitive function. Rowan, you've addressed that before.
Yeah, certainly there was a lot of preclinical observational study evidence suggesting that especially exogenous estrogen was going to be associated with favorable effects on cognition. And then in the Women's Health Initiative randomized trial with over 16,000 otherwise healthy postmenopausal women randomized to either estrogen plus progestin in that one trial where they had a uterus, or estrogen alone, 11,000 women who didn't have a uterus, we had this association with stroke being increased by 40%, and in women 65 years of age or older, actually dementia was doubled in just 3 years of therapy. So that really changed the whole equation from exogenous estrogen is good for cognition and AIs would be bad for cognition and you have to worry about it, to anything that increases arterial vascular events is going to have an unfavorable effect on cognition. And we see in the ATTACK trial, which actually anastrozole is the only of the aromatase inhibitors that has a significantly reduced risk of arterial vascular effects compared to tamoxifen. So I'm really less concerned about it because I think there's no signal now. So I need a new basis for having a particular concern. We don't know what the effect of AIs on cognition is, but I need a new signal to get a particular concern about that side effect with longer-term use.
Paul, AIs and cognition.
Just to say, I think one of the physiological effects of estrogens that cause the complexity of the WHI concept and results is that there are demonstrable benefits in many tissues from estrogens, the cardiovascular system, probably the neurologic system. But counteracting that is the thrombogenic effects of hormones. So one of the explanations for the HRT, I think, is that it enhances thromboembolism or thrombogenesis. And I think that it is quite possible that aromatase inhibition across the general population could reduce the baseline risk of thromboembolism in most postmenopausal women. That's a study that will never be done, but it's feasible that it might. And so while you might have some detrimental effects at the level of the internal intima of the aorta or something, it's counterbalanced, in my view, by diminished thrombosis. And so the jury's out on the net effect.
Final comment from MJ. Clinical situation, how do you approach these women who are hitting 5 years on an AI?
I think I was one of the ones who said it's a coin flip, that I would talk to them about emerging evidence that the risk is persistent, it continues to persist, but we don't know whether it's more beneficial to continue or to stop. And sometimes I've let women take that security blanket because they choose to. Once it's an informed consent, I'm comfortable with it. And it's basically a third of women in my experience say, I'm going to continue to take it, and two-thirds don't once you tell them the toxicities, etc.
Eric?
I just want to say that as much as we all at times find it a chore to follow patients for many, many years, we've all raised very good arguments why we should be following people for a long time. And the truth is, you can't advise someone about their risk or do, as Rowan suggested, make them more anxious or perhaps just make them aware of their risk if you're not following them. And probably without making people anxious, if you have a relationship with them, you can actually begin to talk about going on additional therapies.
Brian and then Mark.
The only last comment I want to make is obvious, which is it depends on the individual patient. I have 60-year-olds who tolerate AIs extremely badly. I've got 80-year-olds that tolerate them extremely well. And your tendency, at least my tendency, to continue or not, really depends upon the tolerance more than anything else. And I was one of those that suggested recommending continuing the anastrozole in an 80-year-old if it is very well tolerated.
Final comment from Mark.
I just wanted to make mention of the fact that we really didn't mention cardiovascular events as a potential risk, and there is some controversy about whether or not aromatase inhibitors might have impacts on that, and that should be also a consideration when you're talking about long-term therapies with these agents.
The next poll question relates to the controversial issue of whether PGR or HER2 assay results should be considered when selecting the type of endocrine therapy being utilized in a patient with an ER-positive tumor, and about half the faculty consider these factors and half don't. The other issue discussed by the faculty relates to the management of patients with ER-positive, HER2-positive tumors in the first-line metastatic setting, and specifically a 60-year-old woman with asymptomatic hepatic and bone metastases. Probably as a direct result of data presented by Dr. John Mackey at the last San Antonio meeting on the TANDEM trial, a number of the faculty, with one interesting exception as you'll hear, recommended an aromatase inhibitor and trastuzumab for this patient. Dr. Mark Pegram began the discussion by commenting on the response to endocrine therapy in patients with HER2-positive tumors.
At UCLA, we've stated since the beginning of this issue that we felt strongly that HER2 is a broad marker for endocrine resistance independent from the type of anti-estrogen therapy. And that's what the data are bearing out. So I don't see how that could possibly be used in clinical decision making with regard to the selection of the type of endocrine therapy. So I would not use HER2 as a clinical deciding factor, because it looks like from the hazard ratios that there's benefit from an AI in HER2 positives as well as HER2 negatives, but the benefit is less marked in HER2 positives and the confidence limits are very wide. But still, it looks like AIs as a class are generally more active than TAM across the board regardless of HER2 status.
Kathy, I think that's kind of a relatively new concept that's come out. I think for the last few years, there's been the impression that AIs, quote, are more effective than, say, tamoxifen in postmenopausal women with HER2-positive tumors. Are you looking at HER2 or PGR right now?
I've been one of the doubters about using HER2 in this setting, and particularly after hearing these most recent data. I think where it does affect me, and I think the data John presented at San Antonio just suggests that the HER2 overexpressors respond pretty poorly to any endocrine manipulation. So I might choose not to use an endocrine manipulation in that setting, but I wouldn't choose which endocrine manipulation.
Brian?
I must say that San Antonio was practice-changing for me. Now, I'm much more in the chemo and targeted therapy areas, but before I attended much more in the PGR negatives and in the HER2 positives to use an AI, and in the ER-positive, PR-positives to do a switch from TAM to AI, whereas now I am thinking much more of starting everyone on an AI up front.
Paul?
I'd love to know what other people feel.
Paul?
I think this debate was confounded to some extent after the original ATTACC presentation, confounded by some very valid and genuine preclinical modeling suggesting that In HER2-positive endocrine receptor-positive breast cancer, tamoxifen actually was an agonist of sorts, and that you had a left and a right biological effect from an AI or TAM, and that argued strongly to go to the AI in a HER2-positive setting. I think what the data are more showing is that while HER2-positivity is a relative endocrine resistance marker, both TAM and AIs are effective in the same direction. It's just that the AI, like in every other clinical setting, is slightly more effective than TAM. So I do use HER2, and I do use PGR in making endocrine decision between AIs and tamoxifen in the following way. I think that the short-term 24-month or 36-month benefit, absolute benefit in all comers with endocrine therapy between AI and tamoxifen is about 1.4 to 1.6% at 3 years. It's a small absolute benefit to choose tamoxifen over an AI. But within that category, you've got low-risk and higher-risk patients. You've got a lower absolute and a higher absolute. And those that have a higher absolute risk probably would do better to have the more effective therapy. So that includes a HER2-positive or a PGR-negative patient. So any patient with a higher relapse risk in the first 24 to 36 months, in my opinion, more strongly justifies the use of an AI upfront over tamoxifen. But I don't disagree with somebody who says, I'm going to give an AI to everybody.
Can you describe the patient in whom you'd start tamoxifen?
Node-negative, very low risk, small tumor, HER2-negative, PGR-positive, ER-positive. So in other words, the patient who at 3 years has an absolute disease-free survival difference between the AI and tamoxifen of something like 0.5% over 3 years.
And then starting tamoxifen was the thought of switching in a couple years?
Right.
And why would you want to do that?
First of all, if you're going to restrict your total endocrine therapy period to 5 years, which currently remains the standard of care, you're taking two different types of toxicity and combining them. So you're exposing the patient to less tamoxifen toxicity and less AI toxicity. There's very good evidence that the bone toxicity of 24 to 36 months of an AI is very limited, if any, of clinical significance. So you're taking an apple and an orange from a toxicity point of view, and you're sparing the patient 5 years of therapeutic side effect to either agent. Secondly, the cost, of course. And thirdly, the known carryover benefit of tamoxifen, which we still have not corroborated for AIs.
I'd like to hear Eric and then Aman respond to that.
Sure. So I largely agree with Paul. I think that both PGR and HER2 are perhaps not predictive factors, but are prognostic factors. And in a patient at higher risk of relapse in the first few years, I am more inclined to use the AI up front. I still am one who believes that there is likely to be a fairly large group of patients who may do better with two drugs given sequentially than one drug. We're still waiting to get results from Big 198. I don't think there were any data at San Antonio that really shed light on that issue. And I personally believe that ultimately it's going to be about more than 5 years of endocrine therapy. And at the moment, I don't give an AI beyond 5 years because I don't think we have either efficacy or safety data. And yet I feel quite comfortable giving a short course of tamoxifen, meaning 2 to 3 years, followed by 5 years of an AI. So for me, a lot of patients still receive TAM followed by an AI, particularly those patients who I think are unlikely to relapse in the first few years on tamoxifen. And in that patient who has a HER2-positive tumor, I am more inclined to use an AI, although, if anything, the San Antonio data made me question that.
Aman?
I think that most of the things which have been said, I agree. But the thing is, if you look at the data carefully, what Mitch Dossett, our Big 98, shows, that patients who are PGR negative and HER2-new positive, the benefit of AIs over tamoxifen is modest, but still it is in the same direction. And the second thing, which from Mitch Dossett data, at least being more familiar with the ATAC data, that patients who we used to think ER-rich, PR-rich patients, we can start with tamoxifen. Actually, if you look at the data which Mitch Dossett showed, the most striking benefit with aromatase inhibitor upfront was in that subgroup of patient, where there was striking reduction in the risk of event. Although these are, again, we have to keep in mind, these are retrospective subgroup of a subgroup analysis.
I want to move on to the TANDEM data, but just bottom line, Aman and then Rowan, Are there patients that you can pick out who you would start on tamoxifen, postmenopausal women?
I personally, again, would say, I have said it a number of times, I cannot say that here is a woman who I should be starting today on tamoxifen. She will be alive free of disease 2 to 3 years down the line. She will not have any major side effects like thromboembolic complications, uterine cancer, and so on. And then I will come back at that point and I will switch her to aromatase inhibitor. We don't have any model, any way, any characteristic of patient or the host which we can identify that subset of patient.
Yeah, I remember we did this last year. I was thinking we needed Jerry Springer's bodyguards when we started to get into this, Rowan.
In my view, as the toxicity profile of AIs becomes clearer, there's less reason for me to worry about trying to use a safer drug. So I really am pretty much starting everybody on AIs. I think one important point is I think it's a mistake to consider the risk of recurrence for the first 2 to 3 years as a target. Because in effect, you're giving therapy, in effect, you're delaying an AI for 2 to 3 years. And so the concept there is, do you think that giving the AI after 3 years of nothing would have the same effect? And I would submit that letting somebody go for 2 to 3 years without a therapy, same thing like giving AC after 2 to 3 years, you're going to develop resistance. So you're not talking about the first 2 years, you're talking about delaying a more effective therapy for 2 to 3 years.
Matt?
I'd just like to remind everybody actually how complex the breast cancer genome is. HER2 is just one of a very large number of amplicons that occur in this breast cancer subtype. We're just in the process of submitting a manuscript which defined 20 amplicons in ER-positive breast cancer, and we've ordered them by their effect on prognosis using a clever bioinformatics trick. At least 7 of them have strong impact on relapse-free and overall survival. So I think what we'll see eventually is a much more complicated, but I think a much more clearer picture of what we're really treating. And I think that we'll enter an era where we'll have to do very large collaborative projects to sort out the precise management for all these different subtypes.
Okay, go, Eric. Yeah.
Neil, I'm sorry. But there is not a shred of clinical evidence that I'm aware of, and I would appreciate hearing it if there is, that delaying starting an AI impairs its clinical effectiveness.
Au contraire, if anything.
Au contraire, if anything. The woman who was shaking her head in agreement.
Go for it.
I was shaking my head in doubt.
Go for it, Kathy.
Well, I think there's the clearest data there can be outside of a randomized study from MA17 that giving it later seems to be quite effective or just as effective. I agree with Eric that there's no evidence suggesting that it's worse giving it later. The issue is the 2 to 3 year period of time in which it's clear that you have some more recurrences. But if that turns out to make the whole situation better in 5 to 7 years, that may still be the way to go. And that's what we don't know yet because we don't have the direct trials.